Before, on your behalf, I welcome Professor Joseph Filer to the school, I want to thank the people who've made this year's Jean Monnet Lecture possible. Tonight's occasion is a joint venture, which I hope will prove the first of many, between the LSE European Institute, whose director, Howard Machin, was quite determined that these various events should happen and has worked enormously hard on them, and the LSE Law Department. The Law Department is grateful to the Shimizu Company for the generous funding which they've given us to use to sponsor lectures, conferences, and to host visits from distinguished academic guests. And tonight's lecture epitomises the type of event they wished us to use these funds for. The European Institute wishes to thank the Federal Trust for its very welcome support. Tonight's lecture is associated with two further events which we hope may form part of a longer-term programme. The first is a joint enterprise between the European Institute and the Goethe Institute, whom I also wish to thank very warmly on the school's behalf for their support. And that takes the form of a seminar to be held tomorrow at the Goethe Institute entitled New Forms of Citizenship in the European Union. And at this stage, I'm asked to say that all the registered conference participants should meet after Professor Weiler's lecture in the senior dining room on the fifth floor of this building to finalise the arrangements. Tonight's audience may also be interested in the annual conference of ASEN, the Association for the Study of Ethnicity and Nationalism, and this will take place in the school on Friday the 18th of April, and further information can be obtained from ASEN at the school. This is the third Jean Monnet lecture at the school, and the event has already established itself as a stimulating and exciting occasion. And tonight, I'm sure, will prove no exception. I'm personally particularly pleased to welcome Professor Weiler on what he tells me is his first, but I sincerely hope not his last, visit to the school. I can clearly remember the first time Joseph Weiler came into my field of vision. As a total novice in European Community Studies and law, I was researching a book on interest representation through law. And I ploughed through a great number of worthy, but to be honest, not terribly exciting articles when I came across a short piece on the Court of Justice which had something new, stimulating and percipient to say, and it was by someone I read named J. Weiler. Since that early article, Joseph Weiler has produced a steady stream of work, most of which has rapidly acquired the label seminal, classic and authoritative, sometimes provocative, but never dull or orthodox. I will not list these articles, which many of us will have read, but I can't move on without mentioning some of the most celebrated. The Community System, the Dual Character of Supranationalism, The Transformation of Europe in 1991 Yale Law Journal, and Journey to an Unknown Destination, a retrospective and prospective of the European Court of Justice. To these classics, we shall undoubtedly wish to add The Reformation of European Constitutionalism in 1997's Journal of Common Market Studies. This work of Joseph Weiler stands at the centre of a new body of work on European constitutionalism, with perhaps special reference to the unique and fundamental role played by the Court of Justice, but also to human rights and citizenship in Europe. It is not too much to say that it has introduced European lawyers to a wholly different way of looking at things European. And we shall all welcome the bringing together of some of these ideas in the shape of a major book to be published by Cambridge this autumn. Professor Weiler's pluralist perspective is underpinned by a profoundly transnational career. He has come to EC Law through international law, to which he adds a deep understanding of United States constitutionalism. Today, he is the holder of the Manly Hudson Chair of Law and the Jean Monnet Chair at Harvard, in which capacity, incidentally, he sponsors an excellent set of working papers on matters of current interest in European studies, with which some of us are also familiar. He obtained his PhD at the European University Institute in Florence, where he produced important work, notably in the field of human rights. The EUI has very wisely never let him go, and presently keeps hold of him through his appointment as director of its Academy of European Law. He is also a founding editor of its European Law Journal, as also of the European Journal of International Law. His long and close relationship with the European Community institutions gives Professor Weiler a unique insider's viewpoint. He has served on the European Parliament's Commission of Jurists, helping both to draft its Declaration of Human Rights and Freedoms and advise on the Parliament's pre-Maastricht position. For the current IGC, he is advising the Commission as a member of the Groupe des Sages. You can see that we are privileged to have Professor Weiler with us, and it is my special privilege to welcome you, Joe, to the LSE. Yeah.
Thank you very much for those very kind and generous words. And it's, of course, a privilege and an honor to be here. I'm also a little bit nervous. I should say that I didn't let hold of Florence more than they didn't let hold of me. I would like to start my lecture on European citizenship with a Talmudic digression. One of the most engaging doors to the study of the Talmud is through the tractate of Pirkei Avot, the Lessons of the Father. It's in Hebrew rather than Aramaic, which makes it more accessible. It is aphoristic rather than exegetic, which makes it more memorable. And its normative appeal is to ethics rather than to law. Like beauty, its banality or its profundity is in the eyes of the beholder. Among the most celebrated intellectual heroes of that tractate of the Talmud is Hillel, Old Hillel. He is most famous for three things. First, he took the impossible imperative in Leviticus 19, love thy neighbor as thyself, and recast it as a much more doable, do not do unto others what you would not have them do unto you, with which we can live. There's, of course, an exquisite irony in doing that, because in his own lifestyle, he did abide by the original Leviticus edict, and not by his own very pragmatic recast. His life was a living ode to tolerance, and in the evolution of normativity, the House of Hillel stands for the indispensability of equity in the hands of the custodians of the law. And finally, he is the author of the following memorable aphorism, sounds better in Hebrew, which can become a metaphor for citizenship and for the principal themes of today's lecture. He said, if not I, who shall be for me? But if I am only for myself, what am I worth? Here we have captured two of the most fundamental questions of all social organization, which citizenship and its closely associated concept of nationality seek to address. Who are we? And how are we to live together? More raw and basic you do not get. His aphorism captures too the inherent tension and at the same time symbiosis encapsulated in citizenship and nationality. The tension between, on the one hand, identity and normativity, between the eros of the I, either individual or collective, and the civilizatory constraint of the social. But it is also symbiosis and not only attention. How we choose to live together also defines who we are. Now, it will be clear to you that in focusing on citizenship and European citizenship, I intend to focus this evening on the affective dimension of citizenship, that part which appeals or does not appeal to our sense of solidarity, to the notions of inclusion and exclusion. And I do not plan to treat in any way extensively the many other aspects of citizenship, its bestowing of legal status, its implication for immigration policy, the questions of who should be granting citizenship or nationality. And above all, and this will be the subject of my discussion tomorrow morning at the seminar, the ways in which citizens, individual citizens, their role in our political polity and in the European public square. We live in an era, both recent but in some ways our entire century, obsessed with the two issues of normativity, the I, who am I, and how do we treat the other. Questions of individual and collective identity, as well as treatment of the celebrated other, the other in our midst, and the other clamoring at our doors or shores, are extremely high on the public agenda in most European societies. Interestingly, as we slouch towards a new fin de siècle, after close to 50 years of European integration, the captivating idea of nation and people and peoplehood have retained a surprising amount of their astonishing allure and grip on our collective psyches. And I do not only refer to the alte neue states in Eastern Europe, where nationalism in some of its uglier aspect is rife. Is the debate in Great Britain about Europe really moved by economic differences on the desirability or non-desirability of EMU, or by political differences of identity and control of national destiny? Was the debate of Maastricht in France, which split the electorate right down the middle, or the rejection of Maastricht in Denmark, not about the same thing? And is it mere teasing to suggest that fin de siècle Vienna, the première edition of 1900, boasted a far more cosmopolitan Geist than its miserable shadow 100 years later today? Now observe carefully that the fault lines of this debate are usually not about differences in self-understanding of the nation and state. So even if in France you have 50% for and 54% against, they are not splitting on their self-understanding of France and nationhood and peoplehood, although some do. The fault really lies in those debates of how Europe will affect that self-understanding, rather than there's a far broader basis of that self-understanding. And yet, with all the attention to this issue, both in the polity and by scholarly writing, the vocabulary of citizenship, nationality, peoplehood, the classical concept from the armory of statecraft and political theory which address these issues of identity, etc., the only ones we have seem to provoke complicated reactions. The words nation, people, citizenry often strike us as cynical when uttered by our political masters, as in the British people want this or the British people want that. Pernicious when employed by the far right of Le Pen or Haider, or embarrassing when discussed in good society other than to denounce them. Who will admit to being a nationalist? The very word is pejorative. Or in an environment which worships at the altar of multiculturalism, who will own up to a thick concept of peoplehood, or even a thick concept of citizenship? A society of others, that is kosher. But think about it, how greedy and cruel some usually comfortably positioned postmodernists are to rob the real others from their unique otherness by claiming that we are all others. This ambivalence may explain why the introduction in the Treaty of Maastricht of a European citizenship and the official discourse, the discourse by the political institutions of the Union, up to and including the recent Irish Presidency IGC summary, the opening phrase of which has the ringing affirmation, Europe belongs to its citizens, has struck so many as problematic. At one level, and to some, it symbolized yet another bold encroachment on the national by its worst antagonist, the supranational. To others, it was anachronistic and puzzling. European citizenship, what is that about? To others, yet, it appeared at best irrelevant, and at worst meriting derision and even contempt. Most, and this is relevant too, have been blissfully oblivious to the introduction of European citizenship. Strange as it may be, all these reactions are partially justified. Let us look a little closer at the discourse of European citizenship. The traditional classical vocabulary of citizenship is the vocabulary of state, nation, peoplehood. It is hard to think of the term unconnected to those concepts. But this means that its very introduction into the discourse of European integration is problematic, for it conflicts with one of Europe's articles of faith, encapsulated for decades in the preamble to the Treaty of Rome, that European integration is about an ever closer union among the peoples of Europe, not the creation of one people, but the union of many peoples. In this respect, Europe was very distinct in its telos from the United States nation-building melting pot idea. And it is also different from other federalisms, like the German or the Australians, which, while purporting to preserve all manner of diversity, real and imaginary, always stipulate the existence of a single people at the federal level. There is a German people. There is an Australian people, despite the federal structure of those states. So to introduce European citizenship really seems to shake the foundations of what the aim ultimately is. If it's a European, if it's a union among the peoples of Europe, there's a problem. The introduction of citizenship then could, in its classical vocabulary, could mean a change in this very telos. European integration from a union among the peoples of Europe to a people, to a union of a people of Europe. With the change of telos would commence, some would hope, some would fear, a process which eventually would result in a slow change in European identity and self-understanding, and the self-understanding of the would-be citizens of Europe, who would become not only formally citizens of Europe, but also such in their consciousness. This model, this way of thinking of European citizenship, is a kind of transplantation model. You take the term as it's mostly understood in its stateal context, and you graft it onto Europe. But in doing so, as I said, you may be undermining the very telos of the Union. European citizenship on this view, the transplantation model, is to many what EMU is to currencies. To some, both Europhiles and Eurosceptic, that is exactly what European citizenship is about. Same way we change diverse currencies into one currency, we change diverse citizenships into one citizenship. It should not surprise us that both Europhiles and Eurosceptics can hold a similar view of what European citizenship is about. We have long understood that often the debate between these two supposed extremes is not a debate of opposites, but of equals. Equals in their insistence of casting political and social organization in exclusively statal national terms. It was hugely fitting and exquisitely right that Mrs. Margaret Thatcher launched a famous attack on Europe in the College of Europe at Bruges. She and her audience, which hated every word she uttered, shared the very same vocabulary, even if using it in opposite directions. It's not surprising, too, that of this view, those opposed to European currency are also opposed to European citizenship. Now, there is an alternative to this view of what European citizenship is or might mean. The introduction of European citizenship to the discourse of European integration could mean not that the telos of European integration has changed, but that our understanding of citizenship has changed, is changing or ought to change. It would be changing because of our understanding of a change in the state and the nation, but also a changed concept of citizenship because of a change in our self-understanding and our understanding of the self. If citizenship classically postulates or is premised on the existence of sovereign states, is it not awfully anachronistic to introduce it again or reintroduce it again in an age in which, as Neil McCormick has so beautifully demonstrated, sovereignty itself has become fragmented, and states constitutionally cannot even pretend to have control over their most classical functions, provision of material welfare and personal and collective security. Now think of the linguistic trio, identity, identical, identify, as we move from the state to the individual. Surely no self is identical to another. Is it trite to recall that identity in an age, our age, the modern age, where choice has replaced fate as the foundation for self-understanding, is it trite to call that identity in this age is to a large extent a political and social construct, which privileges one or one set of characteristics over all others, and calls on the self to identify with that privileged set of traits, and that is then posited as my identity or your identity? Is it equally trite to recall that the modern self has considerable problems from the move from identical and identity to identify? I may be German or Italian or French, but is that my identity? What about being male or female? Or a Stones lover or a Beatles lover, that hates me. As the reference of identity grow, would it not be more accurate in relation to the self today to speak not of my identity, but of my differentity, the particular package which constitutes my identity, which really would be different, and no particular one is being privileged. Do not please confuse what I'm talking about with multiculturalism, at least not the politics of multiculturalism. Whether in the United States or in Hungary, the labeling of people as black or white male, or Jew, or Gentile, as a basis for group political entitlement, is the celebration of a bureaucratically sanctioned polity of multicultural groups composed of monoculturally identified individuals. That's the antithesis of individual differentity. Constructing then a new concept of citizenship around the fragmented sovereignty of the poorer state and the fractured self of the individuals who comprise those states, citizenship as a hallmark of differentity, could have been a fitting project for union architects. That would be the major challenge to the conceptualization of European citizenship. Don't hold your breath. This has not been part of the Maastricht and post-Maastricht political debate. While there has been, what there has been is a far more sorry little affair. There is a story. So what I want to do now is to analyze a bit what are the foundation and what is the thinking behind the introduction of European citizenship and its understanding in Maastricht and how it features in the discourse of the political institutions of the Union. There's a story about the genesis of Article 8 which introduces citizenship to Maastricht, according to which the issue of citizenship was very far from the mind of the drafters of the Treaty of European Union until the very last days, when one prime minister, Felipe González, according to this legend, it's true actually, unhappy with the non-EMU parts of the treaty and conscious of a real brewing mini-legitimacy crisis in the European street, which later was proven true, suggested that something had to be done and that something would be, let's introduce European citizenship. A skeptical IGC quickly cobbled together the citizenship chapter in response. Maybe it's an untrue story, but it could be to judge from the content of Article 8. The treatment of European citizenship, both in the Treaty of European Union and subsequently by the institutions of the member states, is at best an embarrassment. The seriousness of the notion, after all, the cornerstone of democratic polities, and its fundamental importance to the self-understanding and legitimacy of the Union are only matched by its total trivialization at the hands of the powers that be. It is no surprise that, so far as one can tell, the introduction of citizenship by the Maastricht Treaty has had negligible, if any, impact on its subjects, the citizens of the Union. And if any notice were taken by the citizens of the actual impoverished content of that single article chapter in the Treaty of European Union, the reaction would be, or at least deserve to be, contempt for those who drafted it, those who approved it, and for the Union, which can come up with so little to give and so little to ask of its citizens. The benign view would then be to regard the Maastricht concept of citizenship as the result of muddled and hasty drafting. Alternatively, I invite you to consider the hypothesis, which no state or union official may openly espouse, that the citizenship clause in the TU is little more than a cynical exercise in public relations on the behalf of the high contracting power, noteworthy by what it does not do than what it does, and which probably has backfired. The reason I favor the hypothesis of cynical public relation exercise in construing citizenship is the alternative is even a worse hypothesis, an unbelievable, impoverished view of the very meaning of citizenship and its principal components. Can one really credit the hodgepodge of relatively trivial civic artifacts in Article 8 that was believed by any serious official or statesman or woman to capture what European citizenship should be about? A citizenship composed of the right to complain to an ombudsman or petition the relatively impotent European Parliament, provided the complaint concerned a matter which affects him or her directly, with no guarantee of outcome. The right to consular help in foreign countries in case your own country doesn't have a consul, and so on. Does not Article 8 look awfully like one of those carnets of free attractions some tourist authorities give to their visitors to make them feel welcome, and which you accept in the knowledge that the coupons are free because the attractions are not attractive? One has to believe that the high contracting powers understood what they were doing. And it's this, they also understood the importance of citizenship. And it's actually because they understood the importance of citizenship that's what led them to that desultory Article 8. But why then open the Pandora's box at all? It is the current Commission's input to the reflection group and the current Irish draft of the midterm IGC which give us the interpretive key. In the eyes of the Commission, the two key values which make Union citizenship most worthy and thus worth developing to the full are that A, the citizenship reinforces and renders more tangible the individual sentiment of belonging to the Union, and B, that citizenship confers on individual citizen rights which tie him to the Union. Something was going amiss in the relationship of individuals in the Union. Maybe citizenship would be an answer. That the citizen belongs to the Union is perhaps a sentiment important to instill. But even accepting the dubious assumption of the desirability of grafting a national type citizenship ethos onto the community, surely more important is to render tangible, through the concept of citizenship and its manifestation, that it's the Union that belongs to the citizens. Now, this time around in the Irish document, that Freudian slip has been corrected. Now we are told that indeed Europe belongs to the citizenship. But you will look in vain for any meaningful instrument in the Irish draft that would render tangible in any way enhanced, quote, ownership, control by individual citizens over community process. It is, however, not so much the trivialization as the political culture and ethos which underlie the official discourse of citizenship by the European institutions which are important. Not so much what they gave and what they didn't give, but how they were conceptualizing European citizenship in the concept of the Union. What is the political culture and ethos which explain a concept of citizenship which, for example, speaks of duties but lists none? Which speaks of rights of citizens, but not of empowering them politically, which in a dispiriting kind of Euro newspeak denies to all and sundry the nation-building aspect of European citizenship, whilst at the same time appealing to a national understanding of citizenship, expecting it to provide emotional and psychological attachments, which are typical of the very constructs which are being denied. Is it the discourse of civic responsibility and consequent political attachment to all, or is it not closer to the market culture and the ethos of consumerism? Is it an unacceptable caricature for me to think of this discourse as giving expression to an ethos according to which the union has become a product for which the managers, alarmed by customer dissatisfaction, are really engaged in brand development? Citizenship and rights associated with it are meant to give the product a new image, since it adds very little in substance, as we've seen, and make the product ever more attractive to its consumers to reestablish their attachment, their sense of belonging to their favorite brand. The union may belong to its citizens, but no more than, say, a multinational corporation belongs to its shareholders. The introduction of citizenship on this reading is little more than the decision of the board voting for an increased dividend by way of placating restless shareholders. Now note, mine is not an anti-market view, the importance of which to European prosperity is acknowledged, but it is a view which is concerned with the degradation of political process, of image trumping substance, of deliberative government being replaced by a commodification of the political process, of consumers replacing the citizen, of a such and such a European citizenry. Now, part of the problem is not only what they give and don't give, but is how they understand the problem. And my view is that they also undervalue the sense of dissatisfaction or disaffection with European integration. Not by all, but by many. Let me explain. How do we explain the disaffection, which nobody can deny, from Maastricht onwards? And the union senses it, and the institution senses it, because that's how I explain what they had in mind when they were introducing citizenship. But maybe we need to understand it in a slightly deeper sense. The union, first of all, suffers from what one may call a paradox of success. In its foundational period, the European construct was perceived as part of a moral imperative in dealing with the heritage of World War II. Governments and states may have been happily pursuing their national interest, as Alan Millward has correctly taught us, but the European construct could be cloaked with a noble mantle of newfound idealism. Within Europe, war today may be possible among the members of the Union, but it's certainly unthinkable. With the huge success of that principal objective, what Europe is now facing, the way it now emerges, as delivering bread and circus. Remove the moral imperative, remove the mantle of ideals, and it's politics as usual, with the frustrating twist that Europe cannot, that in Europe you cannot throw the scoundrels out at election time. So you try and throw the whole construct out. You become anti-European. Arguably, public attitudes, negative public attitudes, go deeper than that. And this is important to our discourse in citizenship, especially a discourse which focuses on the affective aspect of nationality and citizenship. We come here to a more sobering consideration in this regard, whereby the European Union may be seen not simply as having suffered a loss of its earlier spiritual values, but becoming an actual source of social ressentiment. Care of the highlights of what surely deserves much more than this superficial summary. In his pre-choleric days, Ernest Nolte wrote a fascinating study on the origins of fascism in the various European modes, in France, in Italy, and Germany. In his profound comparative analysis of the cultural political roots of fascism, the common source was identified as a reaction to some of the manifestations of modernity. At a pragmatic level, the principal manifestations of modernity were increased bureaucratization of life, public and private, depersonalization of the market through mass consumerism, brand names, and the like. We're talking 20s here. and the commodification of values, the abstractism of social life, especially through competitive structures of mobility, rapid urbanization, and centralization of power. At an epistemological level, how we understand and interpret modernity was premised on and experienced in an attempt to group the world into intelligible concept, which had to be understood through reason and science, abstract and universal categories. On this reading, fashion was a response to, or of course an exploitation of, the angst generated by these practical and cognitive challenges. Up to here, this is a fairly well-known story. Eerily, at the end of the 20th century, European Union can be seen as replicating, in reality or in the subjective perception of individuals and society, some of those very same features. It has come to symbolize, unjustly perhaps, but we're talking perceptions, the epitome of bureaucratization, and likewise the epitome of centralization. One of its most visible policies, the Common Agricultural Policy, has had historically the purpose of rationalizing farm holdings, which in effect meant urbanization. The single market, with its emphasis on competitiveness, transnational movement of goods and other factors of production, can be perceived as a latter-day thrust at increased commodification of values. Consider how the logic of the community forces a topic such as abortion to be treated as a service. And the depersonalization of this time round of the entire national market. Not only have local products come under pressure, even national products have lost their distinctiveness. The very transnationalism of the community, which earlier on was celebrated as a reinvention of Enlightenment idealism, is just that, universal, rational, transcendent, and wholly modernist. To this, now I'm not suggesting for a minute that the European Union is, or the member states are facing a crisis of a fascism. But I am suggesting, as a result of this analysis, coupled with a postmodernist fragmentation of polity and of political process and integrating factors of the social, that at best the European Union has ceased to be a focal point of solidarity and identification. And to the extent then that that is the problem, that alienation or disaffection is characterized, then citizenship, the way it was conceived, is doomed to failure, because you have to have citizenship works as an effective concept if it represents something with which you can identify, which becomes an iconographical thing for something positive in your life. That is less and less true for more and more people. The failure of Europe in this respect is colossal. Just as Europe fuels the angst of modernity, it also fuels the angst of postmodernity, giant and fragmented at the same time, built as much on image as on substance. It is incomprehensible and challenges increasingly the creencias, the basic beliefs of our daily life. Now, as I said, this is not to suggest that Europe is about to see a return to fascism, nor should this give any joy to fin de siècle chauvinists whose words today are as odious as they were at the start of the century, but it does suggest a profound change in the positioning of Europe in public life, not as in its founding period as a response to crisis of confidence, but 50 years later as one of the causes of that crisis. So what are the alternatives to the official construct, to the Maastricht conceptualization of European citizenship? First, we may ask, do we need European citizenship at all? Why introduce it? Who needs it? The importance of European citizenship is a lot more than a device for placating an alienated population. It goes to the foundation of political legitimacy. The European Union, as we all know, enjoys powers unparalleled by any other transnational entity. It is not a state, and hopefully will not be one, but the powers that it exercises are very state-like. Whence then the authority to do all of this? One place to look for such authority, would be international law. We signed a treaty. I saw Edward Heath on television the other day. We signed a treaty. It's a formalist and non-satisfying answer. To simply say we signed a treaty, pacta sunt servanda, treaty should be observed, cannot lend anything but formal legitimacy to the kind of policy with its constitutional dimension which the European Community and the European Union have become. So if not international law and we've signed a treaty, what then? In Western liberal democracies, public authority requires legitimation through one principal source, the citizens of the polity. The deepest, most clearly engraved hallmark of citizenship in our democracies is that in citizens vest the power by majority to create binding norms, to shape economic direction of the polity, in fact, all the powers and capacity which the Union now has. More realistically, in citizens vest the power to enable and habilitate representative institutions which will exercise government on behalf of and for citizens and the aliens amongst them. Now, you will say, wait a minute, under our constitutional understanding of the treaty, have we not already achieved that? Lawyers recite dutifully. The community constitutes a new legal order for the benefit of which states have limited their sovereign rights and the subjects of which comprise not only member states but also nationals. So the subjects of the treaty, of the union, of the community are not only states but also individuals. So if they are subjects, do they not bestow legitimate authority? It's one of the great legal myths of the last 30 or 40 years. They are not subjects. They are objects, and they have always been objects. You could have a community of slaves, and the powers that control those slaves can decide that those slaves would be entitled not to work more than 20 hours a day. And if they were made to work more than 20 hours a day, they could go to a court who would have to give direct effect to the right not to work more than 20 hours a day. Does that make them subjects of the polity? They remain slaves. So the constitutional understanding we have of the community does not solve the problem of legitimate authority, but exacerbates it. Because now this union, of which individuals, contrary to the legal myth, are not subjects, but objects, albeit objects with some directly affect rights, as women for centuries had, even though they were disenfranchised citizens. That constitutionalized union can pass laws which do not need the mediation of national institutions. Now, citizenship is not only about the politics of public authority. It's also about the social reality of peoplehood and the identity of the polity. Citizens constitute the demos of the polity. In European thinking, not always with some exception, but predominantly, citizenship has always been conflated with nationality. Nationality is the collective side of the citizenship coin. Citizens, the nation, constitute the demos. And that is another way of expressing the link between citizenship and democracy. Democracy does not exist in a vacuum. It is premised on the existence of a polity with members, the demos, by whom and for whom democratic discourse with its many variants takes place. The authority, political theory has a big black hole. It's very difficult to explain. Maybe Locke comes closest. Why the minority should be bound by decisions of the majority. But on one thing we are very clear, that the minority should be bound by the decisions of the majority within a demos, a self-understanding people. That's the premise of John Rawls. That's the premise of most democratic discourse. It's not a semantic point to say that with no demos there can be no democracy. That's the problem in some ways of Irish unification. The people in the north do not feel as belonging to the Irish demos as understood by the people in the south. They think of themselves as belonging to the UK demos. And therefore no man of rights, take the Danes, attach them to Germany, to some newfound Anschluss, and tell them, what are you worried about? You can vote to the Bundestag. You will have all the human rights in the world. They will say, thank you very much. We are Danes, and we want to be ruled by Danes. The imperative of democracy operates within the confines of a demos. But this, in turn, re-raises the problem of citizenship. Who ought to be the citizens of the European polity? How to define the relationship among them? A demos, a people, cannot, after all, be a bunch of strangers. Demos is not only objectively defined, it also relates to subjective feelings. Are we then back to the change telos, to nation building and all that? How should we understand then and define the peoplehood of Europe, of European demos, if we insist that the task remains an ever closer union among the peoples of Europe? So here comes the central dilemma of the effective understanding of citizenship. We are faced, it seems, with a crucial choice. If you reject the concept of European citizenship, you content yourself to living in a polity which may provide you with bread and circus aplenty, but which lacks the core of individual political dignity and public legitimation. You need European citizenship to legitimate democratically the public authority exercised by the Union, because it requires a demos. Adopt European citizenship, and you fundamentally change the very telos of European integration from its unique concept of community to a frankly more banal and boring notion, an undesirable notion of nation building. Unappealing choice. In offering a resolution, or a way of thinking of a resolution to this unappealing choice, I want to bring together three elements which have been at the core of my work in the last 3 or 4 years. First of all, I want to re-articulate my understanding of the special nature of the European polity as encapsulated in the term supranationalism. It is, you will see, a very conservative, with a small c view, since it insists not simply on the inevitability of the nation state, but of its virtues. It's important to me to recapitulate the understanding of what is the European polity. Because if citizenship, European citizenship, is to become an icon of identification, what does it mean to me symbolically, what does it mean to me effectively, when I say I'm a European citizen? It must be some mirror image of my understanding of this polity. The second move in offering a resolution to that crucial choice will be the move to decouple nationality from citizenship. To say that the traditional European understanding which couples nationality and citizenship should be ruptured. I say it's a traditional European understanding, it's actually also an American understanding. Although America, and arguably France, at least in theory, understand nationality in a way very different to the classical Mancini Herder type of a European understanding of nationality, also in the United States there's a conflation of nationalities and citizenship. It's important for my construct to separate the two, because as you will see, I will be arguing towards a fractured or multiple understanding, multiple identity self, which will self-understand itself in national terms at the member state level and in citizenship terms at the community level. And that would be where the way you do this in what I call a truly European variable geometry will give content to the notion of European citizenship, which will remove that unappealing choice. Either you understand yourself as a European citizen and you change the telos, or you give up on the notion of European citizenship, and then you are bread and circus consumer of public authority without control over them. First then, supranationalism. In trying to explain the ways in which the community is or has become supranational, most discussion over the years has tended, interestingly, to focus on the state. And most of the time we talk about the community and states as constituting the major tension and less on the nation. This conflation of nation and state is not always helpful. Supranationalism relates in specific and discrete ways to nationhood and to statehood. To see the relationship between supranationalism and nationhood and statehood, I propose to focus first on nationhood, and then only to move to the more understandable way it relates to statehood. Now, I want to focus on nationhood and explain in particular, since this on the whole is so out of vogue, the promise and virtues and then the danger of the classical or traditional or 19th century understanding of the European nation and the nation state, which still feeds a lot of our public consciousness. It seems to me that at least in the 19th century, the liberal conception of nationhood, two deep values were said or are said to find expression in nationhood: belongingness and originality. And I should say that that's nationhood is not the only social form in which these values can find expression. Belongingness is inherent in nationhood, and nationhood is a form of belonging. Nationhood is not an instrument to obtain belongingness. As a social construct, it is that. Now, what are the values embedded in belongingness, in national belonging, beyond the widely shared view that belonging is pleasant, is good? We can readily understand a certain basic appeal to our human species, which is arguably inherently social, the appeal that family and tribe have too. Part of the appeal of belongingness is simply the provision of a framework for social interaction. But surely it has to go beyond that. After all, much looser social construct than nationhood, let alone tribe and family, could provide that framework. Belonging means more. It means a place, a social home. The belongingness of nationhood is both like and unlike the bonds of blood in family and tribe. And in both the likeness and unlikeness, we may find a clue to some of its underlying values. Since this is the discourse of values, it is like the bonds of blood in family and tribe, in that those who are of a nation have their place, are accepted, belong, independently of their achievements, by just being. And herein lies the powerful appeal and terrible danger of belongingness of this type. It's a shield against existential aloneness. The power of this belongingness may be understood by the drama and awesomeness of its opposites, isolation, seclusion, excommunication. But nationhood transcends the family and tribe, and maybe here lurks an even more tantalizing value. Nationhood not only offers a place to the familyless, to the tribeless, but in transcending family and tribe, it calls for loyalty, the largest coin in the realm of national feelings, towards others which go beyond the immediate, natural, blood, or self-interested social unit. And indeed, belongingness of this type is a two-way street. It is not only a passive value, the value of being accepted. It is also active to accept. Loyalty is one of those virtues which, if not abused, benefits both those on the giving and receiving end. Now, here's a strange thing. When nationality, national bonds are defined in organic, ethnic terms, it's exclusionary, its belongingness may be harmful, fascistic, racist. But a lot of that has been shed from our culture by a new culture of human rights, by a new virtue of tolerance. Shed the organic, ethnic dimension from nationality, and suddenly it assumes a major end of 20th century different importance. It is the context for multiculturalism. Because nationality, exactly because of its artificiality, if you want, is the context which can allow different people understanding them in different ways, having the sense of differentity, to still come together as part of a single nation. There's a new found value in nationality stripped of ethnic organic content in latter-day multicultural sensitive society. The other core value of nationhood, in some ways also an instrument for national demarcation, is the claim about originality. On this reading, the Tower of Babel was not a sin against God, but a sin against human potentiality. And the dispersal that came after it was not punishment, but divine blessing. And the argument is, and I will cut it short, is that the world is a far richer place for the coexistence side by side of different societies, different nations. And this difference is a vehicle for realizing human potentialities in original ways, which, if these distinctiveness did not exist, would not be realized. Now, it is obvious that this way of re-understanding nation is involved in drawing boundaries. Boundaries become central feature of the nation state. And here I declare my own normative or ethical position on this. There is a discourse which in which any drawing of boundaries is bad, is exclusionary, is a sign of hatred. I don't believe that, or I don't share that view of it. For the reasons I just gave, the reasons of belongingness and the reasons of originality, I think the drawing of boundaries can be positive, essential, making the world a richer place, grounding us in communities. Communities require boundaries. They require moral boundaries and they require cultural boundaries. The trick is not to do away with boundaries, but to police these boundaries, to prevent boundary abuse. And nationality lends itself, because of its strong sense of boundaries, to a strong danger of boundary abuse. First of all, of course, there are boundaries in the legal geographical sense of separating one nation state for another, and the abuse of those boundaries is old-fashioned aggression, when one state oversteps or one nation oversteps physically the territorial integrity of another. At a societal level, nationhood involves the drawing of boundaries by which the nation will be defined and separated from others. The categories are myriad: linguistic, geographic, religious, and others. The drawing of boundaries is exactly that, the constitutive act which decides that certain boundaries are meaningful both for the sense of belonging and for the original contribution of the nation. The constitutive element is particularly apparent at the moment of nation building, when histories are suddenly rewritten. It is a social construct, although with time it becomes to feel like naturalistic. And at an individual level, belonging implies a boundary. You belong because others do not. I can only feel that I belong because some people do not belong. Now, I've already talked about boundary abuse in Naked Aggression. The abuse of boundary between nation and state is most egregious when the state comes to be seen not as an instrument for individuals and society to realize that potential, but as an end in itself. That's an abuse of the boundary of the nation. Less egregiously, the state might induce a laziness in the nation. Banal statal symbols like flag and national anthem can become instrumentalities with a kind of phony or false or impoverished originality. But if the state becomes to be conflated or identified with the nation, you might find that kind of national laziness. Instead of a rich and original national production, national culture, you rely on the boundaries of the state to define yourself. And of course, there can be an abuse of the internal boundary, which defines belongingness. The most typical abuse here is to move from a boundary which defines a sense of belonging to one which induces a sense of superiority and a concomitant sense of condescendment and contempt for the other. A sense of collective national identity implies another. It should not imply an inferior other. And this is where European integration and the community and supranationalism come in. They are not a counter concept to nationality. They, if you want, are the boundary police of the nation state. So mine is definitely a thesis of how the European Union saved the nation state, but in this case, in the spiritual sense, or how it could or should be understood, rather than in the material or economic or political or foreign policy sense. How then is supranationalism affect the excesses of the nation state, the abuse of boundaries discussed above? At the pure state level, supranationalism replaces the liberal premises of international society with the communitarian one. The classical model of international law is a replication at the international level of a liberal theory of the state. The state is implicitly treated as the analog on the international level to an individual. In this conception, international relations and international law is the providing a framework where the state can maximize its national interest with minimum interference with the liberty of other states. Now, in the supranational vision, the community as a transnational regime will not simply be in which states will seek to pursue the national interest and maximizing their benefit, but will create a tension between the state and the community of states. Crucially, the community idea is not meant to eliminate the nation state, but to create a regime which seeks to tame the national interest with a new discipline. The challenge is to control at a societal level the uncontrolled reflex of national interests in the international sphere. Turning towards the boundary between nation and state, supranationalism does a remarkable thing. By reducing the possibilities of the state of discriminating on grounds of nationality, it forces the nation, as I had defined it before, to assert itself not by relying on national boundaries, by excluding the products, cultural and material, by excluding persons from other nations and states. You make the state porous, the nation is invigorated in its authentic original regionalism. And at the individual level, it is probably the most remarkable change that is sought to be brought about. At an intergroup level, supranationalism attempts to strip the false consciousness which nationalism may create. It tries to make individuals within the supranational construct not relate to each other principally through the referent of nationality. It diminishes the statal aspects of nationality. This is the value side of non-discrimination on grounds of nationality, of free movement provisions. Hermann Cohen, a great neo-Kantian, tries to explain the Mosaic law which calls for non-oppression of the stranger. In his vision, the alien is to be protected not because he is a member of one's family, clan, religious community, or people, but because he is a human being. In the alien, according to Hermann Cohen, man discovers the idea of the union, of the humanity. We see through this exegesis that the curtailment of the totalistic claim of the nation state and the reduction of nationality as the principal referent for human intercourse, the community idea of supranationalism, is resonant and maintains our Enlightenment ideals of individual and humanity. And that is meant to be the lesson of supranationalism to the individual. Yes, you may belong and find yourself belonging and think of yourself belonging to a national community, but you should curtail the internal instinct of belongingness, which moves from I belong to I belong and I am superior to the other, which does not belong. Now, how does that help us with our understanding of European citizenship? And I will now bring this to a close. The concept of European citizenship that I am suggesting is one that would consciously, in its self-understanding, decouple nationality from citizenship. The whole set of associations of nationality, what makes people think of themselves as belonging to a nation, should remain happily, or unhappily in some cases, at the national level, at the member state level, to be resolved at the member state level. National culture, autochthony, the way we relate to scenery, to the land, the whole range of factors which makes us think as ourselves, as French or Italian or German or English or Scottish or British or Spanish or Basque, but the sense of thick, organic, national self-understanding is not something that should be grafted on or understood in terms of European citizenship. Nationality is a matter for the member state. European citizenship should be between the ears, a rational concept of a civic society, a rational concept of universality, a rational concept of human rights, a rational concept which sees the human behind the national. Now, some of you, rightly, this would sound very much like Habermas's constitutional democracy or constitutional patriotism. It will sound a little bit like the ideal of citizenship of the French Revolution and of the American polity. And it does draw on it, and the content, the specific content that would be given to European citizenship would indeed be borrowed from those sense of Enlightenment, universal modernist values. But there is a huge and important difference. And with this difference, I would like to emphasize and then conclude. The weakness, if there is one, in Habermas's notion of constitutional patriotism is its rationality. It doesn't recognize enough the pull and the power which national feelings has on the human psyche. What is that national pull and feel? Well, I of course acknowledge a huge debt to people like Hannah Arendt or Ernest Gellner and others who have written about it. I want to give my own variant, which is a slight twist on that thinking. The appeal of nationality, the reason for its huge success and for its continued success, is that it fulfills an existential craving for meaning, for metaphysical meaning in life. It answers the existential question of who am I and what am I here for? Because nationality gives you a past. Nationality gives you a future, gives you a destiny. You belong not simply to the society of Mozart lovers, which is also a form of belonging, but you have a history and you have a future. You have a destiny. It's what in the past religion used to do, or at least of certain types. We need that. Whether it's true or not, whether it's socially constructed, and there can be debilitating national narratives of history, and there can be debilitating national destinies. But that is something that constitutional patriotism does not give. It does not satisfy that yearning and that craving for meaning, which feeds so much of national identity and of national loyalty. So, why am I saying that the European citizenship I am advocating, or the way to think of European citizenship that I am advocating, differs from an American-style citizenship, or a French Revolution, or a Habermasian constitutional patriotism? Because I'm saying that it should not exist in and of itself. it can only exist together with a sense of national identity. It's the geometry of the split self. I am, at the member state level, a French national or Italian national. I am, at the community level, a European citizen. Now, it's so important that I want to illustrate this by an example. There's nothing particularly new in saying that the multiple self can have different societal attachment. Neil McCormick says, appealingly, when I'm in London, I feel Scottish. When I'm in Brussels, I feel British. When I'm in the United States, I feel European. I call that the concentric circle model of multiple self-understanding. Because what he's trying to say is, my German colleagues tell me, well, I feel Bavarian and German. What's the big deal? First of all, it is a big deal. But what characterizes the concentric circle model of multiple understanding of national or citizenship belonging is that it's all writ in the same currency, just at different levels of intensity. The sense in which I say, when I'm in Brussels, I feel British, is sort of similar to the sense I say, when I'm in London, I'm Scottish. It's the sense that, where do I feel most at home? By reference to a whole range of association, to language spoken, to landscape seen, to music heard, to people addressed, etc. So when I'm in America, I have this notion of, I feel European, because Europe seems more home to me than America, and Britain seems more home to me than Europe, and Scotland seems more home to me than Britain. I don't want to say that that is a non-starter, that's not a possible way of having a multiple understanding. I just want to explain that mine is different. I really argue for varial geometry. The variable geometry is the way one could have, and once it had bite, understand oneself as, I am French and I am Catholic. It's variable geometry because the way I understand myself as French is very different to the way I understand myself as Catholic. The understanding of my Frenchness goes with the set of association and variables which go to national identity. And the sense in which I am Catholic go to values of spirituality of a different order. It's exactly that which enables me to feel that at some level I belong to a community which is called France and I owe loyalty to them. And I don't owe that kind of loyalty to Germans or Italians or Brits. And yet at the same time I belong to a community of Catholics and I feel part of them and owe loyalty to them. And they might be German or Italian or Brits. It didn't work so much in our century or before, because religion was so craven to the national. But the idea is potent, because now if we go back to the variable geometry of nationality, member state nationality, and European citizenship, member state nationality in this metaphor is the eros, because it relates to that craving of meaning, of belonging, of originality, of destiny. European citizenship evokes a different set of association. Its values, my belief in the universality of certain human rights, my belief in a certain rules of discourse between competing nations, my belief in a different way of understanding otherness. And you will say, so what if there's a clash between the two? That's what it's about. It's about that clash. That clash is exactly healthy. That clash is the way the supranational European citizenship concept civilizes the important, and I've explained it, virtue, eros of national self-understanding. That is the variable geometry of nationality and citizenship. And suddenly, I can say, to say that I belong to a demos, a European demos, which is understood in the vocabulary of values, of shared values, which are encapsulated in this European Treaty and the European Convention on Human Rights and all that goes with it, I am not changing the telos of European integration. Because to come together at the European level on the basis of values does not mean that I am negating or contradicting or changing the telos of an ever closer union among the peoples of Europe. They remain intact, strengthened, and the potential of abuses of national self-understanding much smaller. Thank you very much.
Paper, because it's meant to remind me, to remind you, that if you are one of the registered conference participants, you should meet in the senior dining room on the fifth floor together with our invited guests. And that is nearly all I would like to say, because I have always deeply objected to those chairmen who took copious notes during the lecture and then rewrote it to mean something that the lecturer had never intended. So I will confine myself to two short remarks. Living as I do in a small offshore island, which we sometimes feel is very insecurely anchored to Europe, I am used to giving a particular meaning to the word Eurosceptic. But as we all know, the word skeptic means someone who questions orthodoxies, and As a citizen of this small offshore island, I am, like most of the rest of the citizens, a mongrel or a tabby cat, which means that I once had a distinguished ancestor who was racially pure, but I myself can pass neither the cricket test nor the rugby test. And as such, I very much welcome the impassioned defence of pluralism and the moving of political citizenship and something more than commodification of citizenship onto a supranational agenda. Professor Weiler, thank you very much for the distinguished lecture you have given us tonight.